I'm John Kroll. Today, on this special recorded No Limits, we're going to talk about America's great game, baseball. The longtime leader of the Indianapolis Indians, Max Schumacher, and veteran journalist Mark Monteith have written a book about Schumacher's distinguished career with the Indians. It's called Extra Innings. We'll talk with them about the book, the team, and the game. Because this is a recorded program, we aren't able to take calls, emails, or questions via social media. But we know you're going to enjoy this conversation. Now, this news. Welcome. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. This is a special recorded No Limits. We're going to be talking about America's great game, baseball. We're going to be talking with the authors of a new book called Extra Innings. One of them is Indianapolis Indians legend Max Schumacher, and the other is veteran journalist Mark Monteith. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but I know you're going to enjoy the conversation. Max and Mark, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, John.
It's good to have you here. So I'm going to start first by asking, and don't worry, I'm a baseball nut, so we're going to talk an awful lot about the game and the team, but I want to talk first about the genesis of the book, why you decided to write Extra Innings, why at this point. And I'll start with Max first.
Well, from my standpoint, there were a number of members of the board of directors, most notable Alan Kimmel and Mary Marsh, who had heard some of these stories. And increasingly, as I moved down to the end of my career, they were suggesting that I should write a book, quote unquote. And then they began suggesting a little more aggressively. And when your board begins to to suggest aggressively, you know what you do. You snap your heels together, you salute smartly and say, yes, ma'am, and yes, sir. So we decided to go on with it. While my memory was still good enough to remember a lot of these stories and get it on paper, and we were fortunate to have Mark Monteith, who was available and had experience in this area. And so it was a pleasure to get paired up with him and be able to relate the stories into a tape recorder and have him get them onto paper and eventually get it to the publisher, and away we go. So that was the genesis of it.
Yeah, I know. And the thing with the board, the reason I was chuckling is because that's one of the themes in the book, too, that the boss is, in fact, the boss. That you need to get along with the boss.
Yeah, that didn't apply quite so much to the relationships with the Indians' bosses, because we try to function as not necessarily bosses and subservient employees. We like to feel we're more of a family atmosphere. But out in the real world, I'll call it, in the world I was in before as a kid, and when I was learning some good life's lessons, that was one of the things that I learned from an experience when I was 16 years old, that the boss is always the boss, and I'd be glad to relate the story if you want me to. Otherwise, we can go on to another avenue you might want to take us through.
Well, I'm going to ask Mark how he got pulled into this, why it appealed to you.
Yeah, I got called in on it. I grew up in Indianapolis and went to a lot of Indians games as a kid and had met Max before, so I knew generally his background. But it appealed to me because I know there are a lot of great stories that come out of minor league baseball, probably more so than major league baseball. There's a lot of crazy things going on. So I met with Max. It was probably in May of last year. and got kind of a handle on what the approach was. And I could tell right away that he had just a million stories to tell about his years with the Indians, which goes back to 1957. So as a storyteller, it had a lot of appeal to me.
So, Max, why, you know, take us so you were with the Indians for more than half a century, right?
Yeah, I think it was 60 years when mm-hmm. I retired. And I was in the Army. Well, I graduated from Butler in June of 54, had to wait for the draft call until the following December, and then I had a two-year obligation. So I came out in November of 56 and started with the Indians in January of 57. As ticket manager, it was my first job with the Indians.
What was it about working for the Indians that appealed to you so much?
Well, I'll tell you, it was just good luck. Actually, it wasn't a job that I necessarily focused on when I was in the Army, but I was receiving the Indianapolis Star up at Fort Sheridan, and there was a small article that the ticket manager was leaving the team and they were looking for a replacement. I knew a man, J.R. Townsend Sr., that had been a mentor of mine in Indianapolis, and I knew that he knew Frank McKinney Sr., who was the chairman of the board of the Indians. Mm-hmm. So I asked him if he could arrange an interview for me when I got out of the service and back to Indianapolis later in 56. And he did arrange that, and I met with Mr. McKinney in his Fidelity Bank office down on Market Street in Indianapolis, and 15-20 minute interview, and he gave me a slip of paper with the words written on it that this is the man. It was addressed to the general manager of the Indians named Ray Johnston, and it merely said, this is the young man I talked to you about for the ticket manager position with the Indians. So in other words, he had, based on what Mr. Townsend had told him, because up to that point I had not known Frank McKinney, but based on what Mr. Townsend had said to him, I guess he felt I was okay and could fill the job, and then nothing changed his mind in the interview I had with him in his office. So he wrote out the note, and I took it to the general manager, and the general manager, of course, agreed with his chairman of the board that I was the right one for the position. I was hired, and then I worked up from there over time to eventually become general manager and president and chairman of the board.
What did, and I guess where I'm going with that, I mean, one of the most charming parts of the book is early on when you write about how, you know, well into your career there, you didn't have a reserved parking place. You would park, you know, out there, and that you'd run, jog into the office because you were so excited about getting to work. What was it about that job that you loved so much?
Well, I always loved baseball. My father loved baseball. He was not an athlete, only on the amateur level, so it wasn't that, but he was a native of Indianapolis, and he loved the Indians, and he took me to games. But the way it all started was he would usually park in what was then the CYO field across the street from Busch Stadium. I would jump out of the car and go over to get in line, so after he parked and got over there, he wouldn't have to stand in line so long. And then what I relate to in the book that you refer to is the fact that as I got close to the ticket windows, it just seemed like there was a magnet pulling me closer to the ballpark, and so from a light jog to a faster run, I got to those ticket windows and got ready for him to catch up with me and buy the tickets. So that carried forward to when I started to work for the Indians. I still can recall a light jog from my parked car to get in and go to work in the office. I will admit freely that as the years went by and I got older, particularly the last few years before retirement, I wasn't running to my office any longer, but it always was fun to get there, and I look forward to being there, whether years ago it was as a fan or it was more recently just to be working for the Indians.
Mark, as a storyteller myself, I hear a detail like that, and I think, okay, that's gold.
Yeah, absolutely. You gotta,
what was for you the joy of telling the story? What were the things that you learned, or you just thought, I can't wait to get that down?
Yeah, I think some of the innocence of, particularly in the 50s and 60s, of minor league baseball, and just a team in a small city, and what it meant to a lot of the fans here, and just a lot of the human stories. You know, Max impressed me in that, you know, if one of the Indians players had a dispute with the major league affiliate, Max would take the side of the player if he felt that was the right side to be on. He wasn't a corporate guy who was just trying to impress his boss. You know, he would stick up for players if he thought that was the way to do it. And he had just a pure appreciation for the games and for the guys who were putting on the Indians uniform and trying to make a career in baseball, do whatever he could to advance that career. To me, it was just there's a purity to it that doesn't happen that often in professional sports, where nobody was being selfish and trying to advance his own career or whatever, just trying to do the right thing.
If you're just joining us, this is a special recorded No Limits, where we're talking about the great game of baseball, specifically a new book called Extra Innings. We're talking with the authors, Matt Schumacher and Mark Monteith, about the book. Because it's a recorded program, we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. What was the tough part? And I should say right here, Mark, I really enjoyed the book. It's a fast, fun read. And as a writer myself, I was impressed with the fact, I mean, you're talking about a pretty big period of time that could have been a slog and doesn't. What was the toughest part? I imagine there were some stories that you had to leave out.
Maybe some, but not too much. I guess we did, didn't we? But nothing, you know, real.
We did, and I guess in all candor, one of my disappointments was that when we were through with it, I still had more stories to tell. And the publishers were saying, no, that's enough. If you have more to go in, something's going to have to come out.
Max could have gone forever, you know, with stories. He's got a million stories.
There's volume two then, I guess.
Yeah. You know. Well, his memory is great for things that happened in the 1950s and early 60s, that kind of thing. And I think that's what made the book more enjoyable for me to put together, was that there's these little details that I certainly wasn't aware of as a kid growing up in the city. We go beyond the obvious things, you know, beyond the star players, that kind of thing. There's always things going on in the front office and, you know, conflicts and things like that that people would not be aware of. So, you know, we were able to get into that. And I think that's what makes a book worthwhile, is you go beyond what might have been in the newspaper at the time. And I did do a lot of research in the newspapers of that time, you know, to kind of fill in details. But, you know, we're getting into the front office stuff and clubhouse stuff that nobody had ever reported. So to me, that's kind of what makes a book a book. You know, you're getting beyond the obvious.
Well, and that's one of the things when you recount how some of the seasons went and you're recalling. I mean, was that newspaper research or was that Max's memory that he could call up that, you know, we beat Evansville 7-5 on this date? Were you able to recall that stuff or that kind of detail?
Well, some of the detail, and that's where Mark came in handy, in that he could get into the newspaper and get some basic detail that we felt we needed for it to be a complete story. For the most part, I remembered the situations, and I could relate that. And a lot of them were easy because I associated them with the manager. My first 3 years as general manager, 1961, 62, and 63, we had different managers each year. So I was able to remember what I could associate with the different managers. So that was easy, but there were some years that were more difficult, and that's where Mark's being able to research helped tremendously.
Mark, was that it sounds like one of the really fun parts for you was diving into that period before you were really aware of the Indians and recreating that era.
Absolutely. I'm a former newspaper guy like you are, and that's fun
for
me.
We actually worked together for a while.
Yes, at the news. And it's fun for me to go back into the old archives. In my case, I go to newspapers.com and read the Star and News there. What a godsend that is. And it's fun to go back and read that stuff. It's easy to get lost in it, in fact, and get sidetracked by it. But you have to go back and read a lot of the stories that were in the Indianapolis papers in the 50s or 60s and get those details. For me, was just enjoyable. You know, that wasn't work at all. So, you know, I've done a book with the Pacers as well, and it's the same thing. You know, you go back and dive into that stuff, and it's not a chore at all. It's really a pleasure.
If you are just joining us, we are talking in this special recorded No Limits about the great game of baseball, specifically a new book called Extra Innings. We're talking with the authors, Max Schumacher and Mark Monteith, about the book and about the game and about the history of the Indianapolis Indians over more than a half century. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take calls or emails or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. This is a special recorded No Limits. We're talking about a new book, Extra Innings, written by a legend of the Indianapolis Indians, Max Schumacher, and veteran journalist Mark Monteith. We're talking also about baseball in Indianapolis. Because this is a special recorded program, we're not able to take calls, emails, or messages via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. So, Mark, in the last segment, you alluded to the fact that, you know, you talked about some of the business and the maneuverings, and that's the other part of the book that I found fascinating was that you took us inside. The book takes us inside, in effect, the game within the game, you know, all of the things that have to happen to make things work. How did you go about approaching that kind of material?
Yeah, well, Max is very open about the business aspect of a minor league baseball franchise. And for example, you know, really all his front office people are required to go out and sell, you know, get sponsorships, get advertising for the program, that type of thing. And he even fired a guy once because he refused to sell. And, you know, people have to hustle in minor league baseball to keep that thing going. You don't have a huge season ticket base, at least you didn't at the old Busch Stadium. And it's not that easy to get sponsors and advertisers and that kind of thing. So everybody, including broadcasters and everybody in the front office, has to go out and hustle.
No national television revenue.
Yeah, no television revenue, probably not much radio revenue, right?
Correct.
Everybody's always on call and having to hustle. In fact, one of the longtime Indians employees, Cal Burleson, got the job by volunteering to come in at no salary and just work off a commission and earn his keep that way, and he worked his way into the front office that way. That was an offer Max couldn't turn down because here you have somebody saying, don't pay me at all. I'll just sell and work off a commission. And that's the kind of dedication it takes to keep a minor league franchise going.
The other part of this, and I'd like to hear both of your thoughts on it, was I've been a baseball fan for a long time, and I'm both the father and the son of males who take baseball almost to a religious level. I mean, they're very, you know, for them it's more than a sport. It's a way of life. So I'm fairly knowledgeable about the game and all of that. The part that I found fascinating, though, was how tortured some of the relationships could be with the major league clubs that you're affiliated with. That was one of the things I just found fascinating, is how you had, well, I think at one point in the book, you know, you referred to it as a marriage that works for a while and then doesn't, and then maybe it comes back again. You know, was that one of the toughest parts of the job, Max, was managing those relationships?
Well, it was. Of course, I became general manager. Ony Bush was the president, and he he allowed me and assigned me to do most of the detail work regarding the job. And it was, it was something I had to learn on the fly, but it was fun because back in that day, the AAA general manager had more to say about the makeup of the team than he does today. And so I was trading players. You would trade players to someone you knew in the other league, other AAA league, and with the idea that those players would go back to their original teams at the end of the year, but they were just designed to help you succeed during the year. And at that time, I was very competitive, having come off. I played high school baseball at Shortridge High School, and I played for Tony Hinkle at Butler University. So I was very competitive about the game of baseball. So we were trying to win and thought that was important for our fans. That dynamic has changed a little bit in recent years. And so when we found that the Major League team did not have the interest really in the winning side of our operation in Indianapolis or the financial terms to supply the players from them to us, were offered to us at terms we couldn't accept, well, then we would have to move on to some other kind of an agreement. Sometimes it was painful because you had personal relationships with people with the team, but business was business, and you had to move on.
Well, Mark, you obviously, you're a veteran sports writer. You've covered this sort of stuff. Was any of this new to you? Because, as I say, I know a fair bit about the game, and some of it, I guess I wasn't aware of how fragile some of those relationships were.
Yeah, I think people probably take for granted the relationship with the Major League affiliate and how important that is and how tenuous it can be. You know, the Indians have been with the Reds, two or three times during Max's tenure, and that seems like the ideal setup, the geographic element and everything else. But Max, if he felt the Reds were not dealing squarely, if they were not keeping the interests of the Indianapolis franchise in mind, didn't hesitate to make a change. And, there's always a backstory. There's always things going on behind the scenes that people may not be aware of. And I know, for example, when the Indians left the Reds, initially there was an outcry about that because it had been such a good relationship. But I think once it was explained what was happening, people understood. So Max always kept, the fan base in Indianapolis foremost in his mind and what was best for their interests. And if he felt like the Major League affiliate didn't share that, then he didn't hesitate to make a change.
Well, and the other part I thought, normally we think, I can't think of another way to say this, but the part of the relationship I didn't get was the resentment often about having players called up at, particularly if, you're talking about a major league club that is going to struggle to win 65 games and the minor league team is fighting for the pennant or some, some other goal or frankly, just to put people in the stands. That part I found illuminating because you think that most minor league teams exist to feed the major league team. It's a much more complicated relationship, it sounds
like. Sure, yeah, there were times when the Indians were having a great season and their major league affiliate was not, and yet the major league affiliate is calling up key players to give them a look at in the majors, but, the Indians are trying to win a pennant. So there was conflict about that. I'm sure Max could think of specific examples of guys. And there was, I know, one time when the Indians players protested, that, and wanted a guy brought back. So, yeah, that's the kind of thing that you have to deal with as a GM in the minor leagues.
Yeah.
I think we were more sensitive to the call-ups back some years ago than we are today. I think the fans, and we represent the fans, I think they accept the fact more today that there are going to be a lot of changes. A lot of what I call the yo-yo effect, where they take them to the major leagues for a while and then send them back to us later and then maybe bring them back a second or third time. Major League. Years ago, I recall we had one situation where Eddie Stanky was the calling the shots, and there were recalls to such an extent that there were some fans that hung Stanky from effigy up in the from the grandstand girders at Busch Stadium. So to just to give you an example, today it I think is pretty well accepted. I don't totally accept it, and none of our people do, but in the front office. But nevertheless, you realize that this is the way the business has changed, and there are going to be recalls. Think of it this way. Players come through high school, they come through college. On the amateur level, they may be drafted out of high school, they may be drafted out of college. They are signed to contracts, in our case, by the Pittsburgh Pirates. They go to rookie ball if that's where the Pirates want them to go to start in professional baseball. And then from rookie ball, if the Pirates think they're ready to go to a Class A level team, they'll move them there. And then they'll move them to Double-A baseball from there. And maybe the player doesn't do well and he has to slip back to A ball. But they're making those decisions. And they also are paying the players totally. So they feel as though they should call these shots. And they certainly have a valid point. On the other hand, we have a scoreboard out there in right field that puts the line score up for every game. And we're trying to have a bigger number next to the Indianapolis team than whoever we're playing at the time. So we're cognizant that fans come and they still want to see the team win. They also realize, and we realize, putting on the show, that it's what we have to do is more than the team on the field. It's the ballpark, and the ballpark has to be first-class new ballpark. It has to have all the amenities. Because, after all, in many respects, we compete with the Pacers and the Colts, 500-mile race, so we need to have those things. And so we have to have the stadium clean as a whistle every day. And that becomes, in many cases, more important than the winning and the losing, even though a lot of us don't like to accept that fact. But we have to accept some of it. If it gets out of line, for instance, a few years ago, and Mark referred to it a minute ago, there was the DH issue.
That was going to lead to
Cincinnati
that.
Cincinnati was requiring us to hit the pitcher in every game while our opponents were hitting the DH. Well, you're at a competitive disadvantage when you're doing that. And I told them that I would not accept
unless your pitcher's Babe Ruth, but that's another story.
Yeah, indefinitely. Yeah. And, you know, we were patient in Indy, but there was a limit to the patience. And so there came the time when I had to draw the line on them, and they didn't like the way those discussions were going. And finally they sent back word that they wanted me to sign a new 4 or 5 year deal. I forget how long it was now. And I said, no, the rules were different at that time, so I went out and made a deal with the Montreal Expos, and we announced it in mid-season. So then they came back and begged us to continue and said, we'll go for, well, how about 4 years, and you can use the DH. Well, why didn't you say that 5 years ago? And yeah. I said, I've given you a fair warning to this. So I said, we're moving on. I have a deal with John McHale of the Expos, and I shook hands with him on it, and that's what we're going to do. There's no turning back at this point. Sorry, fellas. So, I mean, that's the type of thing that Mark has referred to, and you have, John, in some of your comments.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with the authors of Extra Innings, Indianapolis Indians legend Mark Schumacher, and veteran journalist, Indiana journalist Mark Monteith. This is a recorded program, so we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media. So I want to ask, Max, was that the fact that this become a much more sort of top-down driven thing by the major league ball clubs? Because when you first started with it, these relationships were, it sounds like they were negotiated almost ad hoc. I mean, it was a real fly-by-night. Now it's much more institutionalized and more the calls are made out of there. Was that the biggest change that happened over time?
Well, the fact that they have more and more control of the details is the biggest change, and that evolved over time. As a, for instance, back in the day, if they were recalling a player, I would always get the call. And he said, tell the manager, you know, at the end of the game to tell Joe Blow that he's come to Cincinnati, and we want him on the plane in the morning. Okay, fine. So I would call the manager, and he would communicate with the player. The player would come to my office. I would arrange the transportation to get him wherever the major league team wanted him the following day, and that would be the end of the transaction. Well, I also did a lot of the paperwork concerned with it. But then as time went by, more and more of those calls went directly to the clubhouse, to the manager. The manager had the trainer right at his side. The trainer would get the plane ticket to the next destination, and it was all taken care of without my hands on it at all. And that's the way it is handled today. I'm sure, too, there are other conversations that take place that go around the general manager in Indianapolis that we would just as soon not hear, and that's a given player. You know, we've been having him at third base for the last several games. We want to see if he can play some shortstop, or we want to see if he can play some second base. We might need him more as a utility infielder in the major leagues, so let's get him some shortstop time and some second base time. Well, maybe he plays them reasonably well. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe he's only going to be a third baseman. And so you have to tolerate that they're calling those kinds of shots. But for the most part now, those calls go directly to the manager, and the manager better do what he hears on the telephone, or probably he's looking for another job the next year.
So, Mark, that is picking up on that. Even the, you know, the practice of sending injured major league players back down to the minors for rehab is not something when I was watching baseball as a kid, you know, in the 60s and 70s that I really recall as a common practice. You were injured and they might bring you back a little slowly, but, you know, what are some of the others in telling this story that you thought? Because telling a story over 60 years gives you a chance to look at the whole thing and think about, oh, wow, yeah, that did used to be different.
Yeah. Max, I may want to throw this to you right away because you...
Rehab players who you mentioned, John, try to tell them in the time remaining for this segment, but they can be good and they can be bad. If the player who comes down is cooperative, he can be very helpful. The Boston Red Sox sent Nomar Garciaprieto to the Pawtucket Club a number of years ago, and he was in Indianapolis 4 days. He was great at signing autographs and meeting with fans, and every day our crowds got bigger for that series with Pawtucket. On the other hand, a guy can come down, he's bored to be down in the minor leagues rehabbing, and he kind of goes through the motions, and you're ready to say to him from about the second day you see him, you sure you don't want him up in the major leagues pretty quickly? We just soon have him out of here. So those are the kinds of situations that some are good and some are not so good. And we relate some stories that tie into that in the book. I think folks who get a copy of the book would enjoy the stories we tell about those situations and many others.
There's guys like Denny McClain pitched against the Indians when he was trying to resurrect his career, and Mark Fidrich.
Yeah,
the same thing.
I love those
in the
stories
80s.
In the book, by the way. Vignettes are really, really well done.
So fans get a chance to see, you know, some major league star players either at the very beginning of their career or at the very end when they're trying to save their career and get back to the majors, and sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. But still, a guy like Fidrich or Denny McClain will draw fans out to an Indians game and become a good asset, really, for the Indians.
And, you know, with those vignettes, what others, and we've got just a few seconds, Mark, what other big changes, just from your sports writer's point of view, when you were looking at the totality of this story, did you see?
And what changes in the Indians?
Well, and then in the way baseball is played as a profession. Now.
Yeah, I think, when Max, in the early years, you know, the segregation was still an element of it. You know, you might recall, you know, the black players in spring training took a different van to the practice or the games than the white guys. That's how, you know, far back Max goes, and it really wasn't that long ago. So certainly social changes have been a factor, you know, with the Indians over the years.
We are talking with Indianapolis Indians legend Max Schumacher and veteran journalist Mark Monteith about their new book, Extra Innings, here on No Limits. It's a recorded program, so we're not able to take calls, emails, or social media messages. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. This is a special recorded No Limits. We're talking with the authors of a new book, Extra Innings. The authors are Indianapolis Indians legend Max Schumacher and veteran journalist Mark Monteith. Because it's a recorded program, we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. So I got to ask, we've talked sort of big picture stuff. I want to get into some of the details here. And I'm going to start with Max on this. But Max, what was in that 60-year history, what was the most exciting moment that you had working with the Indians? One where you thought, oh, God, I'm so glad I
experienced that.
I made the career choice I did, and I was here for this.
Probably 1986, when in Game 7 of the playoffs with Denver, which was the Reds' affiliate at that time, we came from what apparently was losing the deciding game of the playoffs that year to winning in spectacular fashion in the last game of the playoffs, and that involved Razor Shines and him breaking his bat over home plate because he was walked intentionally in the middle of that bottom of the ninth inning comeback to Billy Moore's key hit off Rob Dibble, incidentally, who Denver came in to relief pitch. That had to be the most exciting. When you turn what apparently, and we had some that went the other way when it looked like we'd have a championship won and then somebody snatched it away from us. But that particular time, we snatched it from Denver. And so that had to be the highlight because we had, a very happy clubhouse, and the champagne flowed freely. Players were very happy. We were able to give them all championship rings, and that was probably the one I'm most happy to have had a connection with.
Yeah, as I recall, if I'm remembering the section in the book correctly, that's the one, though, the only person who wasn't really celebrating was Rex Early, right?
That was a different game.
Oh, it was?
That
okay.
was a different game.
I thought I'd gotten that.
Shall we tell a quickie?
Go ahead, yeah.
Quickie on Rex Early?
Yeah, it's okay.
Okay, that was an earlier game. And it was a critical game that the Indians had to win to stay in pennant contention. And once again, we were behind going to the last inning, and we put three runners on base. That was Ron Oster and Jones' first name now, and Harry Spellman all reached base with a walk or a single. Champ Summers was the next one on deck to bat if all those guys got on base and kept the game alive. Mm-hmm. Well, Champ felt badly about our prospects.
Oh, yeah, this is a great story.
He retreated to the clubhouse and with his jersey still on, began to sip a beer and settle in for the evening. Well, the players on the dugout bench, of course, realized what was happening on the field. They said, somebody better go back and get Champ and get that jersey off and get that beer out of his hands and tell him he might have to bat. Well, Rex Early had come to see the game that night, a member of the Indians' board of directors, and he gave up along with Champ, and he decided he would leave and beat the traffic going home. So he missed all that followed. But what followed was Chief, or rather Champ, came back and picked up the bat, went out to the on-deck circle, eventually came to bat with those two runners on base, and proceeded to hit the ball off the top of the right center field fence that scored both runs. The Indians won the game. So Rex Early, the following morning, is sitting with his wife at the breakfast table, and she said, "Well, how'd the game go last night, Rex?" And he said, "Oh," he said, not at all well. Doggone it. He said, we lost the game. That was the big one. We needed to win that one. We lost it." And she has the Morning Star in her hands, and she begins to read it to him. She says, "Rex," she said, "the newspaper said the Indians won last night. Where were you last night, Rex?"
If I might interject, yeah, you know, one of the highlights of Max's career, maybe the highlight, and it's not a single dramatic moment, yeah, was getting the downtown stadium built. Max's performance as the GM and keeping the Indians a viable franchise that people, you know, were interested in, led eventually to getting a downtown stadium built, which is obviously a huge part of the downtown scene now. You know, really, to me, every bit as important as Lucas Oil Stadium and Bankers Life Fieldhouse. Great addition to downtown.
Well, in part because, as I think, you had some good celebrity help writing the introduction preface or whatever, the late Senator Richard Lugar, who said, you know, that 70 games every year there. That's a lot of people.
Absolutely.
And Steve Goldsmith was actually the one. The big push for the stadium came after Dick Lugar's term as mayor, and didn't have any luck during that period. Then Steve Goldsmith was elected mayor, and I spoke to him shortly after he was elected and before he had taken office, and tried to sell him on the fact that a new ballpark for the Indians downtown would be very helpful to the commerce of Indianapolis. And he agreed with me, and we proceeded to get together on a deal. The city put $9 million into the construction of the ballpark, and the Indians put $9 million into the construction. So we got it done, and he came to me a year or two later, and he said, "Thank you for your advice, and the way this has all worked out. It's worked out exactly the way you said it would, and Victory Field has been a tremendous addition to downtown Indianapolis." So I appreciated the fact that he shared my dream for the park downtown, and then shared with me the fact that he thought it was successful as we thought it would be, and as we contracted between the city and the Indians for it to be.
Mark, put your sports writer's hat back on for a second. Talk about it, because, you know, a lot of the people who live in this city can't remember a time when the Indians ballpark wasn't downtown, that period when, you know, when it was on 16th Street and all of that. What a transformation that was, both for the culture and really for, you know, the sports fans, baseball fans.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the old Busch Stadium, or it was sometimes called Victory Field over there on 16th Street, you know, it had been there since 1931 when it was called Perry Stadium. And obviously a lot of people liked it and were nostalgic about it, had been going to games there since their childhood. Mm-hmm. So when, you know, the plan was announced to go to a downtown stadium, there was some blowback. Not everybody was in favor of, because they were used to Busch Stadium, as it was called then. But there's, you know, no question the downtown park now is so much better. The old one was literally falling apart. It was just not safe to be there. Yeah, the new one has suites, which are an important revenue source. Mm-hmm. The fact that it is downtown adds a great deal to it. It's just in a better area. So, you know, the Indians, to me, John, are such an important part of the local sports scene, mm-hmm, in that people have a more relaxed attitude about them, and they just want to go to a ball game on a nice summer day or evening and watch, and they don't get as hung up on the results of the game as they do with the Pacers and Colts. And people get mad at a major league franchise like the Pacers or Colts, even if they're winning sometimes. We never hear people complain about the Indians, you know, whether they're not having a great season, whether they, you know, don't have a great manager or players. People are always happy with the Indians, and I think the Indians help keep the sports fans here sane and appreciative of just having a AAA franchise.
How much of that is also a product of the fact that you know, you can say if you work here in the city and it's a beautiful, you know, day on the spur of the moment, let's just go see a ball game.
Yes.
And you really can't do that with the Colts or the Pacers. I mean, going to one of those major sports things is much more of a commitment.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, much more of an investment of your dollar, if nothing else. But with the Indians, if the day's beautiful and there's a game that night, hey, let's go. And the tickets.
And you can just walk right up to the gate and buy the tickets.
Yeah, the tickets are not outrageously expensive. And you could sit on the lawn or you could sit anywhere in the stands and see a game.
Low-cost, family-friendly entertainment. You will see a very competitive baseball game in a beautiful stadium.
I would argue most fans really can't see the difference between AAA and a major league game, right? You know, I mean, it's high quality baseball.
Well, and I would argue it. As I say, my son's a baseball player, and I've been to, I think, 20 of the major league parks. I actually prefer going to minor league baseball games, in part because they act like they really want you there. That's not always the case with major league ballparks, it's almost like you're an inconvenience to be there. So I realize this is not going to help me with major league team owners, but sorry, it's the way I feel.
I think a lot of fans feel that way.
Yeah, and it's a pleasure to go see. And, you know, all of these parks now, Victory Field being one of them, they're built like cathedrals. I mean, they're just gorgeous.
They figured out how to build sports facilities, and you know, Victory Field is a great example of what a baseball stadium can be. And to me, just the fact it's called Victory Field, that they haven't taken corporate sponsorship. They could obviously find a corporation to put their name on it and get a check for that, but they want it to be called Victory Field. They want it to be something there just for the fans.
So, Max, I'm going to ask the dreaded question here. You know, it's sort of like, which is your favorite child or whatever, but you got a chance to see an awful lot of great ball players through the years. I mean, there are people who played for the Indians and went on to do phenomenal things. Who did you find the most fun to watch?
Well, the most fun to watch was Razor Shines, because when we first talked with the Expos about starting to work with them, Bob Gebhardt of the Expos told me, he said, I will wager with you that after the first month of the season, your most popular player will be a guy named Razor Shines. And he was right, because Razor related to the fans so well. I like to say about him that Razor was kind of an average player the first five or six innings of a game, but put the tying or winning run on base in the seventh, eighth, and ninth innings, and he was as formidable as any player I've ever seen in AAA baseball. He would drive in the big run for you. He lived in Indianapolis. After a time, he established his residence here and was active in the community, and so he became a great fan favorite. And like I said earlier in our discussion, actually, he was so frustrated that he couldn't be the one to drive in the winning run in that a big game against Denver, that he broke his bat over home plate. And Kurt Hunt, who was one of our public address announcers some years ago and the business manager of the team at the same time, hung on him the Razor Shines that fans related to. And Razor, actually, Mark here, actually educated me that Razor was actually, there was a reason for that name, that was his father and grandfather's middle names. And I had asked Razor, the name that I put on all his contracts was Anthony Razor Shines, Anthony Raymond Shines, Anthony R. or Anthony Raymond. And I would ask Razor from time to time, where did the Razor come from? Because I had these thoughts in my mind that I wanted to clarify. Well, he never would enlighten me on that. So Mark added some depth to the book by coming up with that detail.
Razor did the afterword for the book, so that he's a part of it. And he was kind of the Indians' version of a Reggie Miller or Peyton Manning that he was with the Indians a long time and was hugely popular.
Well, and I remember, you know, in that era when he was playing was also the era that Bull Durham, the movie, came out, and there were an awful lot of references to sort of he was Indianapolis's answer to Crash Davis, the Kevin Costner character in there, the worldly veteran who loved the game and kept playing just because he loved the loved the game and had the kind of hold. So who was the player you least enjoyed dealing with, Max?
Jeez.
How many of them were there?
I don't know. I guess the only thing I'll say, well, I'll tell you who it was. Yeah, I will name one. Fritz Ackley, 1961, was a right-hand pitcher for us, and he was a good one, good triple-A pitcher with a major league future. And Fritz, though, he had a tremendous year. He was the pitcher of the year for the league that year. But every game that he pitched that he won, particularly the home games, he would be up my office wanting a raise immediately. And I'd say, Fritz, we don't do business that way. Just because you won the game last night, congratulations, but you don't get a raise for it. We expect you to pitch well. He was from Hayward, Wisconsin, and he continued to do that all through the 61 season. His implication always was that he could go back on that fishing boat and make a better living than pitching Triple-A baseball. But he never walked out on us. He stayed with us till the end of the season. Like I say, was the pitcher of the year for the league. And so he was my least popular because when I saw him walking through that door, I thought, oh, here we go again.
Was he doing that, do you think, because you were relatively new at the general manager's job and not that much older than those guys?
He might have thought he had a pigeon, but on the other hand, if I'd given it to him, we were working with the Reds that year, and I'd given it to him, a portion of that money would have been paid by the Reds, and I would have heard about it from them. So and you just can't make that kind of a precedent just because a player has a good game. You can't bonus him on the spot. You know, we expect them to play well, and we don't dock them when they have a bad game.
So I'm going to ask real quickly, you know, since you have retired and all of that, you still like going to the ballpark?
I do. I don't run from the car to the inside any longer, but I do enjoy going out there. It's different, of course, because it's somebody else's operation, and I have to recognize that things get done a little differently. But I have always felt that the greatest thing that an aging executive in any business can do for the organization he's working for is to leave it in good hands and to have mentored people who can operate that business successfully after you're gone. And with Bruce Schumacher and Randy Lewandowski at the helm of the Indians, I think I have done that, and that's probably my greatest contribution over the years to the Indians and baseball in Indianapolis.
And, Mark, the book is out now, right?
Yes.
And available where?
In all the local bookstores, at a Barnes & Noble, or at certainly at the gift shop at Victory Field that's available.
Okay.
Books a Million out near Traders Point, any local bookstore. Also, of course, it's available on Amazon.com.
That'll have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Max Schumacher and Mark Monteith, for a great conversation about baseball and the Indianapolis Indians. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neil Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.